from KQED.
This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Randi Zuckerberg joins us for this Forum segment. She's a Harvard graduate who worked in marketing in New York, and she moved west and became an early member of the Facebook operation founded by her brother Mark, where she led live streaming initiatives and brokered major deals with both ABC and CNN, and she's presently CEO of Zuckerberg Media and editor-in-chief of Dot Complicated. The Hollywood Reporter named her as one of the 50 digital power players, and she's the author of a children's book, Dot, as well as Dot Complicated, Untangling Our Wired Lives, and joins us for this Forum segment. Glad to have you. Welcome.
Thanks. Great to be here.
I have to begin, actually, I want to talk about your book and talk about Facebook, lots of things, no dearth of things, obviously, to talk about. But I love this quote from Chris Rock, and I didn't know where it was from, where he says, "You only live once, so make sure you spend 15 hours on the internet every day desperately seeking the validation of strangers." that's pure Chris Rock. Was that from one of the stand-up routines, or I guess?
I found it on Twitter, surprisingly enough, but I thought it just really summed up very well this world we live in today, where you keep in close contact with strangers thousands of miles away, sometimes at the expense of the person right next to you in your own living room.
Well, that's what your book is all about. I mean, it's all about the difficulty of not so much the life-work balance as the life-tech balance, as you define.
That's right, because now your work goes home with you. Gone are the days of closing down your desktop computer, going home for dinner. Now work comes home with you and your life goes into work.
Or you don't have a life because you're too much at the computer, as you kind of point out to us valiantly and I think importantly. And we'll talk about your own story, because your own story plays a significant, if not integral, role in all of this. I know you did that Bravo show, that reality show on Silicon Valley, but I thought maybe a better show might have been your own story, eating in Wendy's with Steve Forbes and then winding up with this ragtag bunch in Palo Alto.
You never know where life's going to take you. That's the beauty.
Well, that's one of the big lessons from your book, certainly. But it does take you into different dimensions, and it takes you ultimately into this importance of navigating between all the technology that's at our fingertips and trying to live a life outside of a virtual realm.
That's right. And it's interesting because I had 6 years on the front lines of Facebook. It was an incredible opportunity. And I got the ability to just interact with so many different industries, see how social media was changing television, Olympics, global elections. Incredible. But at the same time, I was also a mom myself. And so I felt like I had two conflicting sides. I had the technologist in me that was obsessed with innovating and disrupting. And then I also had the side of me that was watching my son engaging and interacting with tech, 6 months old, engaging with it and having the same questions as any other parent about screen time, no screen time. And that really led me to write this book, because I felt if I have a complicated relationship with technology, surely millions of people have a complicated relationship with technology.
Did you keep that smile machine for your son that you found in your father's dental office? A good way to introduce him to technology. This is, you take a smile off somebody, you put it on somebody else, and you were kind of obsessed with it as a kid.
We were obsessed with it. It was this huge, clunky machine in my dad's dental office where you could sit next to someone and it would swap your smiles. I thought it was so cool. Now, I bet there's an app to do that on the iPhone.
Of course there is. There's an app for everything. But to come out here was, in many ways, a daunting thing to do. I mean, your brother at that point hadn't gone on to fame and fortune. And fame and fortune, many people know from The Social Network, which you take a nice shot at in this book. unlike most of the stories, this one is true.
That's right. Why let the truth get in the way of a good story? I mean, for sure. But you're right. You know, there were a few things. First of all, I have to admit, I was one of those New Yorkers who didn't even think that life existed beyond the borders of Manhattan. So to think that I would be happy moving out to the suburbs of California to work on a project with my brother seemed like the farthest thing from reality in my mind. But I write about in the book what it was like to go out and visit them and just fall in love with Silicon Valley and with the ideals of entrepreneurship.
And the excitement of a startup, even though, you know, you're giving your lifeblood to it and you're working sometimes more hours than people should be on without sleep and all that. But at the same time, you know, one of the things that surprised me in your book was when your brother sits down with you and puts a napkin in front of the two of you. I mean, this is the way they do it really in the corporate world. Not necessarily what one would expect of siblings. He puts down a figure, puts down essentially a salary for you as well as stock, and gives it to you and you write back. I mean, this is the way one associates with corporate oligarchies, not necessarily with brother and sister, but that's the way it was done, right?
You know, I quickly found out a lot of business gets done out here on napkins. Who knew?
And this has been a good move for you, obviously. I mean, you were in marketing before and you had a whole career.
That's right. So I studied marketing at Harvard. I was studying business psychology. I went to work at Ogilvy & May, their advertising agency in New York, and at Forbes. So I definitely had a background in digital marketing, although it's funny. I write in the book about how I was so disappointed to get staffed on the new team at Ogilvy, digital and interactive, when all of my friends were being staffed on Mad Men-like television campaigns, and how that ended up just being a huge blessing in disguise for me. But joining Facebook, it finally felt that I could really have ownership of something, bypass so many layers of my career. It was very exciting.
Let me ask you about Facebook before we get on to other matters that you bring up in the book, particularly this balance that really is at the heart of your book. Many critics have said that Facebook really pushed the envelope on privacy to the detriment of users. So let me just give you some examples from Business Insider. 500 million Facebook users may have had information leaked to advertisers in 2011. Facebook introduced automatic facial recognition features in 2011, which, of course, upset many users. Facebook offered developers access to users' addresses and phone numbers in 2011. And in 2012, Facebook got sued for using people's names and photos and advertisements without their permission. So Facebook's changed a lot of these policies, I recognize, and you've been away for a few years, but you were an executive during these years, and obviously these were things you were chewing on.
It's interesting because we didn't have another company to follow in their footsteps. We were blazing this entirely new trail. And when you think about it, there are a lot of times in the past, I talk in my book about the example of caller ID, because I remember when caller ID first became a reality and everyone was up in arms. You know, what do you mean that people can now see that I'm the one calling them? But now fast forward 20 years, and if you don't recognize who's calling you, you often don't pick up the phone. So I think it's a fine line between pushing forward innovation, but also making sure that you're constantly listening to the feedback of your user base and dialing things back if you feel like you're crossing the line, which Facebook did do a number of times upon getting feedback.
So this is a mea culpa. I mean, you did cross the line a number of times. You failed because there was no paradigm for you. There was no model for you to follow mainly. Is that?
I think we were testing a lot of things. I think we were pushing boundaries forward. Now, also, you have to understand, people are always resistant to change. There were so many things that we launched at Facebook that people at first said, no, don't change the way it is. And then people would double their usage of the site. So I think it's always, as any company in Silicon Valley, what I would advise them to do is understand that people are resistant to change and try to figure out if your user base is rebelling. Is it actually cross the line what you've launched, or are people just being resistant to change and they're going to move? But one other thing I want to add on that too is that I've been looking, you know, now as an outsider, I've left Facebook 2 years ago. I look at the numbers of all of these sites of Twitter and YouTube and Facebook, and the numbers keep going up and up and up. These are free voluntary services. People could leave at any time, but people keep joining in droves, which seems to me as an outsider now that perhaps the media is more concerned about these issues than people actually are.
Randi Zuckerberg is here with us in studio. By the way, she will be at the Commonwealth Club tonight at 6 p.m. She is the author of Dot Complicated, Untangling Our Wired Lives. And I'm looking actually on page 49 when you say, I saw in my own life, this is really kind of a key epiphany for you, I think, that I was having difficulty balancing tech and non-tech moments. People talk a lot about work-life balance, but in today's society, it's really more an issue of tech-life balance. As an entrepreneur traveling the world speaking while also trying to stay connected to my family, my friends, and my team, I reached a point when rather than owning a computer, a phone, and a tablet, those devices were owning me. And this is why you and other people like Tiffany Schlain talk about digital Sabbaths and all these kinds of things, but also the sense of kind of awakening to the fact that you're more on these machines than you are making real contact. Isn't that why you decided to have a wedding, not the kind you dreamed of with hundreds of people, but a small one in Jamaica?
That's right, because it used to be your wedding. That was the only opportunity you had to connect with your college friends or people you hadn't seen in 10 years and bring them back into your life. But now we know the minutia of everyone's lives who we've met. And so now I think as society, we're craving for more intimate experiences and more fewer but deeper friendships. I think we're maturing alongside of social media.
And things are changing exponentially in ways that none of us can really predict. But I also find myself in reading your book thinking, does she know about Gestalt psychology? You know, you concentrate on the moment. You be in the moment. You look at a flower, let's say. I mean, you know, this takes me back, of course. But, you know, there used to be all these sessions to get you to concentrate on being in the here and now. Carpe diem, seize the day, etc.
No, it's funny. And I had a professor in high school who always used to tell us, you know, kids, have you stopped and smelled the flowers today? And we'd laugh at him because we were 16, 17 years old and we, you know, had our whole lives ahead of us. And now I am that person with my son who's saying, you know, let's stop and smell the flowers. But it is interesting. I think the fact that we're always connected is both the best thing and the worst thing about our lives.
And let's talk about the best things because, you know, there are some who are naysayers on that score. What do you tell us are the best things?
Well, gosh, I think especially as a working mother, there's so much conversation right now about women in business, women in Silicon Valley. There's no way that I would be able to do anything that I'm doing now without these devices, the ability to be always connected while on the road, having more flexible schedules in terms of when and how I work. It's really phenomenal, the freedom these devices have given us to blaze our own path. And also, I think with young children, it's easy to talk about the risks of putting technology in front of children, but there's so many benefits to teaching digital literacy at an early age and the apps that promote creativity, art, love of learning. It's really phenomenal what you can teach a child early on.
Let me be the devil's advocate for a moment. Maybe the angel's advocate. I'm not even sure. But, you know, you see all these kids now and they're looking on these and they're not even looking up at all. So one of my nephews doing this, I said, when is he going to lift his head up from, you know, and be involved this way? And there's also the addictive side of it, which you do bring up in your book. You know, things are going off in our brain. And
absolutely. They're treating children as young as 4 years old in some parts of the world for tech addiction.
It's real.
Yep, it's absolutely real.
So there's, again, like you say, the positive side, the negative side, and finding that balance can be very difficult.
I think you're right. And I always tell parents, I think technology, it should feel special. It shouldn't just be a daily habit for young children. It also, I think it's very important to make sure that when children are using tech, it's something that's enriching their minds and creativity. You're not just passively putting them in front of a screen as a babysitter.
You don't by any chance know the name Ted Rozak? I'm probably dating myself again.
But I will look it up.
Well, he was a historian and an author of many books, someone I admired a great deal, who used to come on Forum and talk with us about various issues. Very animated, vital, passionate guy. And he wrote a book called The Making of a Counterculture, which was kind of one of the defining books of that generation. And he also came to the conclusion that we are so wired that we're actually hurting creativity in children, that it's actually diminishing the creativity in children.
I think you could definitely make a case for that. I think you can make a case either way. I'm very interested in the longitudinal studies that are being launched now around young children in tech. I think it's very early to be able to tell that. Now, on one hand, I see even just anecdotally with my own son, his exposure to instruments through the phone has just blown my mind at his love and depth of music knowledge at age 2. On the other hand,
it's a boy named Asher, by the
yes,
way.
Yes, boy named Asher.
Yeah, it makes me think of Chaim Potok.
Yes.
My name is Asher Lev. That's a name that you don't hear that often anymore.
A nice Hebrew biblical name. Yeah. But you're right. On the other hand, you wonder when children aren't exposed to the elements, to their imagination, when everything's so 3D laid out for them, are we leaving anything to their creativity? And as adults, when we're constantly distracted by texts, emails, Facebook, when we feel like we always have to respond, are we leaving ourselves any room for creativity?
My producer says, who's Chaim Potok? He's a novelist that I just dropped in here for who wrote a book called My Name is Asher Lev, but probably better known.
A wonderful book.
Better known for other works as well, like his earlier book about Hasidim. But let me go. You go to relationships in this book, and you know, I hear people complaining all the time. I wonder, I think I have your take on this, but I'd like you to sort of spell it out for us. They get a set up on a date or they meet somebody for the first time and they get all this information. You know, everything they want to know is there, available to them. It takes away some of the mystique, obviously, doesn't it?
It does. And again, I think there's always a glass half full and half empty on any of these. Now, we can have an instant dossier on anyone we ever meet. Now, on one hand, you're right. It does take some of the mystique out of it. On the other hand, for those of us who can be a little scary to be meeting someone for the first time, whether it's a date, a job interview, a new friend, it allows you to break through the ice a lot more. You feel like you can actually jump into areas of conversation that you know the other person will be interested in. It also, knowing that the other person is going to be searching for you, just like you're searching for them, allows you to think about putting your best foot forward online.
I remember when some of those cyber dating, well, sites first came out, you know, people would, women friends of mine would joke and they would say, I say, you're not a serial killer, are you? Or something along those lines. I mean, we're talking to Randi Zuckerberg. Her book is Dot Complicated. Her brother Mark connected over a billion people as founder and CEO of Facebook, so it might come as a surprise. But she's a former Facebook executive herself who's written a book about the this was a surprise, about the hazards of social media in her book Dot Complicated. And she recommends digital downtime in order to improve your real-life relationships. And we're discussing her book. We're discussing Facebook and other matters, and she'll be at the Commonwealth Club tonight at 6 o'clock, and you can talk to her. In fact, let me invite you to do that. Our toll-free number is available, and you can call us now. It's 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment. And you can also, of course, go to Facebook page or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. And here's a tweet that says, I'm noticing a trend of former social media executives warning of personal tech overload. Is this professional hypocrisy or a useful cautionary tale?
Interesting. I think, you know, it's just a matter of those of us growing up alongside social media. I've become a mom now, which is has been a very defining moment of my life. And it's caused me to look at the role of the relationship that my son will have with technology and think, gosh, if I don't love the role that technology plays in young children's lives today, what am I going to do now to change that?
Listener writes, and I read this with all due respect to you and all you've accomplished, because you write about this whole thing about being overshadowed by your brother. And here's somebody who says, there are thousands of people with better skills than Randi Zuckerberg in Silicon Valley. Her fame is borrowed from her brother.
Well, what I would say to that person is I'm thankful that I don't need their approval to be successful.
Splendid response. Mary writes, how can parents help their kids learn the importance of taking a break from social media or digital downtime? How can we show that real life interactions are just as important, if not more so, than online presence?
I'm so sorry. Can you repeat that one more time?
How can parents help kids learn the importance of taking a break from social media?
Gosh, well, I think that's a wonderful question. And one of the things that I always tell parents is that before you even set rules and boundaries for your children, it's important to take stock of your own behavior. Because so many parents, I find it's easy to tell their children, don't overshare online, and then those same parents are turning around oversharing.
Do as I say, not as I do. Famous words of John Mitchell, former attorney general.
That's exactly right. So I think it's really important to note our children take their cues from us. So if we demonstrate the importance of boundaries, children, it's easier for them to follow suit.
Getting back to that critical remark about, you know, she succeeded because of her brother or things along those lines, you know, you talk about sort of a couple of different things that were going against you, not only in terms of maybe people identifying you with Mark and trying to get close to you to get close to him and all of that sort of thing, but which would be expected or anticipated, but also being a woman in Silicon Valley. We've done programs on this,
yeah.
And there are many challenges there as well.
Definitely. It's definitely a double-edged sword. On one hand, both having the last name Zuckerberg, being a woman, it puts a lot more attention on anything you do, which can be both a wonderful thing and a horrible thing. It can be a wonderful thing because it provides opportunities that I may not have gotten otherwise early on in my career. On the other hand, it firmly places a bullseye on your back in Silicon Valley. And for me, I felt often that I had a double bullseye on my back. I think everything you do is a bit more scrutinized and under the microscope and open to a lot more judgment from the peanut gallery.
But you did some things that you write about that really should instill a great deal of self-pride, and I assume it does. They do, particularly, you know, getting that, the president of the United States, no less, onto Facebook.
That was a real career highlight for me. We used to do these things called hackathons at Facebook, where you'd stay up all night and work on just a passion project that you had based around the internet. And I dreamed up this idea of doing kind of a live television show entirely on Facebook, what that would look like for the future of media. And 6 months later, to have the White House ask if President Obama could come on that show and talk to America, it was just an amazing defining moment.
Amazing high, as they say, in triumph in many ways. So I'm going to ask you a question you probably have never been asked before. Would you, right now, give all this up if you could be a major Broadway singer and use that singing voice that you really wanted aspired to use?
Oh, gosh. It's so hard because my life has taken me in a very different path. But you know what? I really, really want to sing on Broadway before the end of this journey is over. So probably yes.
Could I twist your arm? I'd get you to sing a cappella right here on the air.
Oh, gosh. What's your favorite song? Do you like Somewhere Over the Rainbow?
As my daughter's here, and I can still see her in my mind. She's in the control room. I can still see her in my mind at age 3 looking at Judy Garland singing Somewhere Over the Rainbow. So now we'll have Randy Zuckerberg do a little rendering.
Oh, yes. My goodness. A cappella, sitting down at my finest. Somewhere over the rainbow, way up high, there's a land that I heard of once in a lullaby.
Your career is made. This is Broadway bound. They're applauding in the control room.
Thank you. That's better than Broadway singing for you guys here at
KQED.
Thank
you. We recognize our importance eclipsing Broadway. But
now I don't have to give up my dreams of Facebook to do Broadway. I've already recognized it right here, bucket list.
And more of a bucket list. We'll get callers on here. Miriam joins us as our first caller. Good morning.
Good morning. First of all, I'd like to say, Randy and Michael, it's an honor to speak to you both. I wrote an essay last semester in college regarding Facebook and antisocialness with it. And Randy, I just tuned in very few minutes ago, and I just was wondering, why did you pull out of Facebook? Is it because you felt that the social network of it was actually antisocial?
So thank you for that question, and thanks for tuning in. I still love Facebook. I use it every single day. I'm still a shareholder in the company, so a huge believer in the wonderful positivity that Facebook's bringing into the world. I do think that at that time, though, I had just had my son. He's 2.5 years old now, and I started to notice things about our world that I hadn't noticed before. I noticed people at restaurants texting instead of looking each other in the eye. I noticed people at concerts viewing the concert through their mobile phone. And I just started to think more and more about how maybe all of the success and weight we were putting around innovating and disrupting things in Silicon Valley, maybe the average mom, the average business person in the middle of America didn't necessarily celebrate all of this innovation and disruption. And I felt I owed a bit of responsibility back into the world to untangle our wired lives, if you will.
You also had a wake-up moment with your son in kind of a near-emergency situation that you write about. Yeah.
I did. And there was a real moment at about 6 months old that I noticed on his face how agitated he would get if he felt like he was competing with a phone for my attention and my love. And I thought, gosh, do I want my son to grow up feeling like he's competing with a device for his own mother's attention? That was a big wake-up moment for me. So I truly believe that the benefits of tech and social media far outweigh any of the negatives. We just have to be very mindful about how we use all of these tools.
We're talking to Randi Zuckerberg. She is editor-in-chief of Dot Complicated, a digital lifestyle website, by the way. And her new book is called Dot Complicated, Untangling Our Wired Lives. You may be seeing her on Broadway sooner than later. And actually, you should go on one of those shows.
Thanks to the audition I just had
Yeah, maybe you should do one of those shows like The Voice, I'm thinking.
That's not so
out of the realm. You could even go under maybe a pseudonym. But we'll go to another caller first. Karen, hi.
Hi. I've experienced both the positive and the most negative aspects of social media, and I wanted to ask if her book covers a technique that I can't find information on online that's used as an abuse called controlling, where someone takes control of your account and multiple friends' accounts to harass. And it's over 6 months, and I still don't have control of my account, even after a disk change and multiple password changes, and haven't been able to get help. And if it's been found when that happens, if it's someone working within the organization or within a law enforcement organization that is abusing the system.
Gosh, well, I'm so sorry to hear that that's happening to you. You know, it's not something that I cover in the book. This is actually the first instance that I'm hearing of it. And
but you do cover privacy issues.
I do talk about privacy issues a lot. I also talk a lot about anonymity, because I think that online, and maybe this is part of the problem that's going on, is that people, when they feel like they're anonymous behind a screen name, they're using a pseudonym, they say and they do things that they would never, ever do to your face and in real life.
It's the whole flaming phenomenon. Yeah.
That's right. And so what we have right now is we have this interesting thing going on where people, they want to use the tremendous gifts we've been given online of having a voice, but they don't want to take responsibility for their actions and what they say. So I talk a lot in the book about what this means for sites that allow anonymity online. And I take a very strong stance on that. I am very anti-anonymity online. I think the internet will be a much better place when we're required to be our authentic selves and log in with an identity, a driver's license to the internet, if you will. And hopefully that removes a lot of problems like this controlling problem where people can't hide behind anonymity and pseudonyms to
maybe
do
you could
horrible
give
things.
Karen some practical advice. I think, you know, people who have problems with Facebook complain generally about a behemoth bureaucracy that they can't get through. It's like an iron curtain or something. I mean, is there some way that she could take her concerns to a higher authority? Could you give her some advice on that? I know you've been gone for two
years. Gosh, you know, I've been gone for 2 years. I think the systems are very different. I think, you know, obviously, what I know from being inside Facebook is we tried to react as quickly as possible when things happened. I think maybe the best thing to do is to rally some of your friends to also be contacting on your behalf, because as you can imagine, even with the biggest customer service teams in the world, you're still probably getting millions of people who are writing in every day, and they're trying their best. I know that dealing with situations like this was at least very, very, very important to the company while I was there. I'm very sorry that this is something that you're dealing with.
Good luck, Karen. And well, we've come to the end of the hour already. Just a note from Bruce on an email, a lot of emails, but let me just read this because you mentioned caller ID. It says, I miss having phone conversations as much as I used to. Being updated online about what people are doing means I don't have to talk to them as often. When I call my brother's family and say who it is, my nephew will say, I know, because of caller ID.
I know. The surprise and delight has gone away a bit.
Well, it's been surprise and delight having you here with us and hearing you sing. Thank you for being with us this segment.
Thank you for asking.
Randy Zuckerberg's new book is Dot Complicated, Untangling Our Wired Lives. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. An hour is repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. Remind you that you can continue this conversation on our website, kqed.org/forum, or on the Facebook page, if you like. Forum's produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai. Our senior editor, Dan Zoll. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.